American Free Press Audio Edit in Issue 37 and 38 September 9 and 16, 2019. Famed Arizona sheriff will seek re-election. Illegal aliens, radical leftists praying Joe Arpaio will not win. Patriot lawman blasted for speaking to American Free Press. AFP had the great fortune recently to sit down with former Maricopa County, Arizona Sheriff Joe Arpaio, in which Sheriff Joe filled us in on what has happened since we last interviewed him in May. This interview was conducted by AFP reporter Dave Gallery. AFP, thanks, Sheriff, for taking the time to sit down with us, especially after some pretty nasty leftist organizations have smeared you for being courageous enough to talk candidly with us in the past. We understand you are running for your old job in Maricopa County. How is that going, Arpaio? I think you did a great article last time we talked. One day, I saw a sign up that said Joe, one more time, a digital billboard, and it started some interest in my quest to become sheriff of Maricopa County again. And then, people on Facebook and Twitter, via cards and letters, hundreds of thousands of people in the last 2 months, basically said, we would like you to run again, and that sort of swayed me. Not only that, I travel around the country and wherever I go, people recognize me, and they come up, say, we're sorry you're gone. So, regardless of all the critics, especially the fake news media, I think, after running 7 times for office, I recognize a gut feeling when I have won, and a silent majority. So I talked to my wife, and she agreed, and we decided on August 25th to kill 3 birds with 1 stone. That's my wife's birthday. That's when the president pardoned me, and that's when I announced that I was going to run for sheriff again. AFP, has the media covered this, Arpaio? Yes, except Fox, of course. They haven't had me on for a year. That's very interesting. Since I've known them for 24 years, I've had local media call me. I did not do a press conference. I simply told everybody that I would meet them one-on-one, just like I'm talking to you. And so I feel good about it. AFP, it looks like Arizona needs you, Arpaio, right? We're being flooded with drugs coming across the border, and I like to think that when we used to grab all these guys, I was doing a favor for the whole country, because most of these drug smugglers were trying to come through Maricopa County into other areas. These are the drugs that are killing our young people. AFP, what about all the smears, Arpaio? I see a lot of big media people calling me a convicted felon. I'm not a convicted felon, so I'm fighting back. I'm suing Andrew Cuomo, CNN, Rolling Stone, The Huffington Post, The New York Times, and a few others. I don't like suing the media. I've worked closely with the media my whole career, but you have to take a stand. This is getting ridiculous. They are trying to destroy me, and that I don't like. These mainstream newspapers and TV stations seem to copy what others say. They ought to do some research. I'm not taking any prisoners in this race. Whatever it takes, I'm gonna win this election. From what I see, the current sheriff is doing nothing. I want to make Maricopa County safe again. I am proud of the fact that I got 560,000 votes in the last election, even though they had the mayor of Los Angeles importing people to march down the streets carrying signs against me. We have a sanctuary county now. AFP, you have had a lot of experience. What are they saying about that, Arpaio? They throw my age out there. It's not Joe Arpaio, it's Joe Arpaio, 87. Every time they mention my name, they throw the age in. I'm not worried about my age. I've been working 14 hours a day since I retired. So, they wanna hit me on the age issue. Let them hit it. I'm gonna continue my illegal immigration fight, within the parameters of the U.S. Constitution, and I'm going to keep fighting the drug traffic. I am officially out of retirement. AFP, politics is such a dirty game. Are you sure you want back in, Arpaio? There's no such thing anymore in politics as loyalty. All they worry about is getting elected, and they flip-flop. But I will work with Republicans and Democrats alike. We all should stick together and try to get something done. The Democrats, all they care about today is going after President Trump. I'm going to Chicago in September. I was invited to speak. I'm going there to speak right smack in the midst of the African American neighborhoods. I wanna go right smack in the middle of the Hispanic neighborhoods. I'm gonna try to get their support, try to talk to them and tell them my side of the story. I want to help them solve some problems. Funny thing is, they call me a racist, but I've got two grandkids. One is black and one is Mexican. My son is married to a wonderful Latina, and I would not trade those kids for anything in the world. AFP, some of our readers would like to help. Arpeo, if anybody wants to donate to my campaign, they can go to www.arpeoforsheriff.com. I think we're set up to take donations. Also, they can see twitter.com/realsheriffjoe, 101,000 followers, and then I have a Facebook page, 666,000 likes, that's building up now. Listen, I'm going for broke. I'm gonna get to my seventh term and that'll be 28 years, and get that office back, for the good of the people of this county and this country. We're gonna turn this thing around that's been destroyed in the last 3 years. AFP, how will you deal with criticisms that AFP is some kind of a hate group? Arpeo, AFP isn't my public relations arm. I look at you guys as people trying to tell the truth, and you can't say that for other news media. I just got blasted by the news media when you interviewed me, and they said you guys were critical of Jewish folks and all that. I don't go around checking articles you guys write. You call me, I talk, as long as you are being honest. I support freedom of the press. We need more outlets like AFP, believe me, that would tell it like it is. But all the media, they seem to be in bed with powerful, politically correct people and they have their agenda. I've never seen anything like it. I've been dealing with the media for 55 years, but this has gone too far. So, I want to thank your publication, at least, for speaking out. Whether people agree, whether I agree, it doesn't matter. The power of the press is impressive. They can sway elections. When there is a mass shooting, the media can talk about it. Most corporate news outlets make it political, about gun violence. It's really sad. They'll definitely blast me for talking to AFP again, but I have a right to talk to you guys because you guys don't twist my words. AFP, thanks again, Sheriff, for having the guts to speak with us. We will be keeping a close eye on your race, and we all wish you the best. It's time to cancel the cancel culture. There's a popular old adage that says, rules are for thee, but not for me. A similar expression goes something like, rules are for little people, and when it comes to leftists, these sayings are quite appropriate. They regularly point fingers, make accusations, and mob good people, all the while conveniently overlooking their own gaffes and general bad behavior. In the years before the internet, it used to be considerably harder to smear someone on a national, let alone global, scale. The accuser would have needed a massive platform like a cable news network or a major newspaper to do it. A few sleazes like the Southern Poverty Law Center's, SPLC, Morris Dees and David Brock of Media Matters figured it out. They knew how to exploit the media. And if they wanted to hide their own past acts, it was easy to do, because, in spite of what you may read today, leftists have always dominated the news industry, and they generally stick together. Today, however, all a keyboard warrior needs is a cell phone and a data plan to target individuals and groups with whom they disagree, and they can do considerable damage in what the kids these days are calling call-out and cancel culture, generally speaking. Here's how it works in the age of the internet. An individual, who's usually on the left of the political spectrum, will see something on the internet that offends him, rather than simply ignore it and move on. However, he will quickly formulate the beginnings of a smear campaign, firing off a volley of abrupt tweets or posts faster than most people can even button their pants. He then calls on others in his social circle to join him in condemning the poor, unfortunate soul, who then do the same with their social circles. The smear is then heard around the world, until, before you know it, thousands of people are chiming in. Often, even before the target has time to defend himself, hundreds of strangers have taken to calling him all sorts of horrible things, judging his life, claiming to know his very thoughts, condemning him for the crime of wrong speak. Within a few minutes, the original wrong speaker will have been doxxed. His name and address passed around freely, and his employer and neighbors might have been contacted by rapid mobs and activists, journalists with the sole intent of destroying their target entirely. This is no exaggeration. There have been many cases of this happening to people over the years. In 2013, for example, just before 29-year-old public relations executive Justine Sacco boarded a plane from New York to South Africa, she tweeted a joke, "Going to Africa, hope I don't get AIDS, just kidding, I'm white." She had been on her way to visit family over the Christmas holiday, but before she even departed the plane after the 11-hour flight, her joke had been forwarded to tens of thousands of people, her employer had been contacted, and she had been sacked. Over the years, groups like the George Soros-funded Media Matters for America have taken cancel culture to the next level, figuring out exactly how to capitalize and profit off of this, building up millions of followers who willingly and gleefully join in the roasting and the very kinds of public shaming that early Americans outlawed as cruel and unusual punishment, even if the accusations were false. In the past decade alone, multi-million dollar smear machine Media Matters has gone after many conservative organizations and individuals in an effort to tarnish their reputations in the eyes of their supporters with outrageous claims that they don't even verify are true. For full disclosure, Media Matters has repeatedly targeted this newspaper. One way they have done this is to call out advertisers and threaten a public shaming by alleging AFP is some kind of a hate group to be shunned. But they will also call out public figures whom AFP has interviewed and threaten them, as well. One of those intended victims was Sheriff Joe Arpaio. Once Media Matters heard that Arpaio was running for his old office, he ordered up one of its whiny hit pieces on that patriotic American lawman. But Joe has a stiff backbone, and refused to buckle. You can read his candid interview with AFP's Dave Gahiri on page 1, and on page 12 of this week's issue. Editor and designer Paul Angel, in a light-hearted, pointed commentary, refutes the pathetic little fictional tale Media Matters repeats verbatim again and again about AFP. It's also quite funny because one Media Matters executive has been exposed by a popular conservative talk show as being more racist and anti-Semitic than anything AFP has ever been accused of. It's long past time for all the sane people of the world to band together and cancel culture. Especially when it originates with groups like the New York Times, the ADL, the SPLC, and Media Matters. Christopher J. Petherick, executive editor, FBI stonewalls on the release of damning Strzok page memos. By Donald Jeffries, the FBI stonewalling effort to release further text messages between former lovers and bureau employees Peter Strzok and Lisa Page. Conservative legal watchdog Judicia Watch has been attempting to obtain these messages for quite some time, according to the organization's director of investigations, Chris Farrell. The two FBI officials' bias against Donald Trump was so overt that in one message Strzok joked about being able to smell the Trump supporters as he shopped in Walmart. Farrell and Judicia Watch are most interested in unreleased texts that may contain specific names, dates, and places. This story exemplifies how slowly the wheels of justice grind in this country, when assets of the intelligence community are involved. Over a year ago, in April 2018, Department of Justice Inspector General, IG, Michael Horowitz officially referred fired Deputy FBI Director Andrew McCabe for criminal prosecution. McCabe's multiple lies under oath to FBI agents and investigators for the Inspector General were documented in a report published by the Office of the Inspector General. That would seem to be a clear example of perjury. To quote from the IG report, "We found that, in a conversation with then-Director Comey shortly after WSJ, Wall Street Journal, article was published, McCabe lacked candor when he told Comey, or made statements that led Comey to believe, that McCabe had not authorized the disclosure and did not know who did. This conduct violated FBI Offense Code 2.5, lack of candor, no oath." We also found that on May 9, 2017, when questioned under oath by FBI agents, McCabe lacked candor when he told the agents that he had not authorized the disclosure to the WSJ and did not know who did. This conduct violated FBI Offense Code 2.6, lack of candor under oath. As federal prosecutors mulled over whether or not to charge McCabe on charges of lying to federal agents, CNN hired the former FBI deputy director, President Donald Trump's attorney general, veteran deep state insider William Barr, notably refused recently to prosecute former FBI director James Comey, despite the referral from the IG. According to The Hill, the Justice Department was, laughably, worried about looking petty and vindictive. Even Senator Lindsey Graham, RSC, called Barr's decision shocking. Trump told reporters he knew nothing about the situation but repeated his earlier statement that the former FBI chief had illegally leaked classified documents to the press. Trump also boasted on Twitter about total and complete vindication and exoneration from the Russian, WikiLeaks, and every other form of hoax perpetrated by the DNC, radical Democrats, and others following the dismissal of the Democratic National Committee's multi-million-dollar lawsuit against Trump and Russia, further confounding his loyal supporters. Trump celebrated Barr's refusal to prosecute Comey, tweeting, "The fact that James Comey was not prosecuted for the absolutely horrible things he did just shows how fair and reasonable Attorney General Bill Barr is, revealing again the curious perspective he so frequently takes, that of a powerless outsider rather than the President of the United States." Trump also claimed, "So many people and experts that I have watched and read would have taken an entirely different course. Comey got lucky." Trump's comments contradicted his earlier tweet that the disastrous IG report on James Comey shows, in the strongest of terms, how unfairly I, and tens of millions of great people who support me, were treated. "Our rights and liberties were illegally stripped away by this dishonest fool. We should be given our stolen time back." Washington, D.C. Attorney Mark Zaid offered a deep state apologia for Barr, telling The Hill that Comey's mistakes were relatively common within the government, and that prosecuting him would force the Justice Department to pursue many more cases like it. The New York Times summed up the feelings of the establishment in a recent article: "Federal prosecutors in Washington appear to be in the final stages of deciding whether to indict Andrew G. McCabe on charges of lying to federal agents, according to interviews with people familiar with recent developments in the investigation. But prosecutors may face headwinds if a case were to go to trial. One prosecutor quit the case, Ms. Shields, and has expressed frustration with how it was being managed, according to a person familiar with her departure. And a key witness, Ms. Lisa Page, provided testimony to the grand jury that could hurt the government's case." Additionally, Washington juries are typically liberal, and prosecutors could end up with jurors sympathetic to Mr. McCabe who believe that he, not the president, is the victim of a political witch hunt. Though the meetings between Mr. McCabe's lawyers and top law enforcement officials suggest that prosecutors seem intent on moving forward with the case, they could also decide to pass on an indictment. It would be an unusual move if prosecutors were indeed planning to charge Mr. McCabe. A crisis in the Electoral College institution was created to ensure states with smaller populations aren't left out. By St. Patrick, the Electoral College, one of the longest-standing constitutional mandates never to have been eroded, may be on the road to complete abolishment within the next decade. Currently, it is under fire for diluting the decision of the popular vote, but that was a major factor of the founders' original intent, and for good reason. In late August, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Tenth Circuit ruled that an elector cannot be legally bound by either the popular vote or the candidate to which they have pledged. The Constitution allows an elector to vote however and for whomever they see fit. An elector, ruled the court, has the same constitutional rights as a regular voter, who also cannot be legally bound to a candidate or party. The case involved Michael Baca, who, at the meeting of electors in Colorado, was a part of a group called the Hamilton Electors. Those electors had decided that both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton were unfit for office. Colorado's 9 electors were supposed to go to Clinton. Nebraska and Maine are the only two states that do not have winner-takes-all rules and thus allow a splitting of the electoral votes based upon the proportional outcomes of the state's popular vote. Baca crossed Clinton's name out and wrote in Governor John Kasich, R. Ohio, then Colorado Secretary of State Wayne Williams, a Republican, removed Baca as an elector. A move the court has decided was illegal. There are two sides to this difficult constitutional conundrum. One side, expressed by current Colorado Secretary of State Dana Griswold, a Democrat, says, this court decision takes power from Colorado voters and sets a dangerous precedent. Our nation stands on the principle of one person, one vote. Griswold views the Electoral College as a constitutional formality, a process that should absolutely mirror the state's popular vote. If electors are completely free to vote for the candidate of their choice, then we have a process that exposes electors to bribery, threats, political persuasion, peer pressure, and potential extortion. On the other hand, the Constitution does explicitly allow electors the freedom of the ballot. Amending that freedom would require changing a tenet of the Constitution. While the rights of the electors have been a significant issue in recent years, others have continued to debate whether the Electoral College is still a valid institution in 2019. They have wondered what purpose the Electoral College really serves, if, as happened in 1876, 1888, 2000, and 2016, the winner of the popular vote, the will of the people, lost the presidential election. The Electoral College was designed to increase the importance of the nation's heartland, which, at the time, meant states outside of Virginia, Massachusetts, and Pennsylvania. Why would a small, independent state agree to form a more perfect union, after all, if the voices of its people will be muted by the population centers of the new country? The creation of the Senate, wherein every state has two senators regardless of population, also serves the function of creating an equilibrium between states. The House of Representatives is different. It is more democratic in that the number of representatives for each state is allocated by census figures. The founders were distrusting of mob rule, the emotional whims of the people, even when they were an organized mob. In Federalist No. 68, Alexander Hamilton laid out the reasons for an electoral college system that was detached from and not beholden to the nation's office holders. Because the electors were not politicians, per se, they would also not be influenced by foreign interests, a legitimate concern in 1787, which now would have shifted to a fear of an elector having a long-standing tie to corporate interests. The people would choose their electors in a much more direct election than it would the president himself. In Federalist No. 10, James Madison worried about an interested and overbearing majority. The number of electors for each state are the sum of its U.S. representatives plus U.S. senators. 2. It is the addition of the mandatory two senators that brings Wyoming, America's least populated state, close R in electoral value to California, which is America's most populated state. Without the Electoral College, candidates would have to concern themselves only with the major population centers of the United States. The heartland, the part of the country that many coastal elites already deride as flyover states, would be rendered voiceless. One person, one vote would still exist in Wyoming or Alaska, but it wouldn't matter. Wyoming today has 577,737 residents. That is the size of Oklahoma City and smaller than Las Vegas, Milwaukee, and Louisville. If the popular vote was the sole deciding factor, why would a candidate ever step outside of New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Houston, and Philadelphia to campaign? The Electoral College is the sole lifeline for medium and small states in presidential elections. It is possible that Nebraska and Maine have already offered a potential solution, if the country is willing to see it. If all states split their electors proportional to their popular vote, then the popular vote would be better represented, yet the smaller states would still retain their number of electors. Neither party, however, may be willing to bend. Democrats, pro-popular vote, know they control the population centers, and Republicans, pro-electoral college, know they dominate the rural regions. Neither wants to move in the opposite direction and thereby lose control of what currently benefits them, shutting down Tulsi DNC working to keep Gabbard out of debates. By Donald Jeffries, the Democratic Party has clamped down on its only anti-war presidential candidate, Rep. Tulsi Gabbard, D. Hawaii, in an attempt to trim the countless numbers of presidential aspirants. The party issued a decree that to continue to participate in the next round of debates, A candidate had to have achieved a rating of 2% or higher in at least four polls approved by the Democratic National Committee, DNC, while Gabbard has exceeded 2% in 26 national and state polls, including those run by establishment outlets like The Economist and The Boston Globe. Only two of them are on the DNC's certified list. Journalist Michael Tracy of RealClearPolitics.com wrote, Tulsi Gabbard is on the verge of being excluded from the next Democratic presidential debate on the basis of criteria that appear increasingly absurd. Gabbard memorably demolished establishment favorite Senator Kamala Harris, DeKalb, in an earlier presidential debate this year, while Harris's support appears to have plummeted as a result of Gabbard taking her to task for her abysmal record as Attorney General of California. The feisty populist hasn't climbed in the unreliable, unnecessary, and prejudicial pre-election polls. In post-debate online polls, however, Gabbard has consistently shined, dominating all of her Democratic Party peers. Such a glaring dichotomy between internet opinion and mainstream polls is curious, to say the least. It immediately evoked comparisons to the 2012 Ron Paul presidential campaign, when he crushed all opponents in every internet poll and drew bigger crowds than all the other contenders combined, yet wasn't officially credited with a single primary win. Gabbard has incurred the wrath of the liberal establishment with her populist stances. The hosts on the television talk show The View were openly antagonistic during her guest appearance, and comedian Stephen Colbert practically went apoplectic at her anti-war stance when she was on his show. Gabbard has also introduced a bill to audit the Federal Reserve, is outspoken about the deadly GMO food products, came out strongly for civil liberties and the free speech of those she disagrees with during one debate, and has been the only high-profile politician to speak out publicly in support of hounded whistleblowers Julian Assange and Edward Snowden. Considering the in-your-face corruption from the 2016 presidential campaign, revealed by WikiLeaks, that exposed a glaring effort to rig the primaries for Hillary Clinton over Bernie Sanders, one would think that the Democrats would be a bit more circumspect this time. The Democrats did everything they could to steal the nomination away from Sanders, who was drawing far bigger and more enthusiastic crowds than Clinton, even feeding her debate questions in advance, and utilizing the power of the ridiculous superdelegates to give her a majority in many states where Sanders actually won the vote. The media bias for Clinton was so obvious that at one point, when Sanders had won eight primaries in a row, the mantra from virtually every journalist was that Hillary's nomination was inevitable. The presidential debates have long been used to exclude the rare outsider who attempts to attain the nation's highest office. Ralph Nader was notably excluded from presidential debates, again for supposedly not reaching a certain threshold in approved polling. Pat Buchanan not only wasn't permitted on stage when running as the Reform Party's candidate in 2000, he was scorned and attacked by every pillar of the Republican Party establishment after pulling off a dramatic upset in the 1996 New Hampshire primary. Buchanan was cheated out of what seemed a clear win in Arizona. Former Arizona Governor Fife Symington actually phoned Buchanan's state headquarters that afternoon and congratulated him on what the polls were showing to be a victory by a wide margin. While networks reported a huge Buchanan lead all throughout the day, suddenly Steve Forbes was said to be winning, with Bob Dole second and Buchanan lagging behind in third place. There were numerous irregularities, including the voters being permitted, for the first time in the state's history, to vote in any precinct they wanted, and an incredible 60,000 voters receiving special duplicate ballots that allowed them to vote twice. After the first Democratic Party presidential debate of 2019, the most Googled name in the country was Tulsi Gabbard. After the second debate, Gabbard was at the top of Twitter's trending list. Twitter simply removed her. Gabbard is now suing Google for $50 million. Google's discriminatory actions against my campaign are reflective of how dangerous their complete dominance over internet search is, Gabbard stated. This is a threat to free speech, fair elections, and to our democracy, and I intend to fight back on behalf of all Americans. Neither Buchanan nor Paul ever really publicly questioned the electoral fraud that derailed their presidential runs. Donald Trump notably did, even though he eventually won. Will Gabbard call out the rigged process? Is the Federal Reserve trying to meddle in U.S. elections? By Dr. Ron Paul. The Constitution never granted the federal government authority to create a central bank. The founders, having lived through hyperinflation themselves, understood that government should never have a printing press at its disposal. But from the very beginning of America's founding, the desire for a crony central bank was strong. In fact, two attempts were made at creating a permanent central bank in America prior to the creation of the Fed. Fortunately, the charter for the first bank was allowed to expire in 1811, and President Andrew Jackson closed down the second bank in 1833. But, unfortunately, a third attempt was successful, and the Federal Reserve was unconstitutionally created by Congress in 1913. Americans have been living under a corrupt and immoral monetary system ever since. The Federal Reserve is the printing press that has financed the creation of the largest government to ever exist. Endless welfare and endless military spending are both made possible by the Federal Reserve. The Fed can just print the money for whatever the U.S. establishment wants. So those of us who long for a constitutional and limited government have few tools at our disposal. Despite all the propaganda claiming independence, the Fed has always been a deeply political institution. Because the Fed is a government-created monopoly with key government-appointed employees, its so-called independence is a mere fiction. However, Congress created the Fed with legislation. It can also abolish the Fed with legislation. Recently, the facade of Federal Reserve independence was dealt a severe blow. Ironically, the person who broadcast to the world that the Fed is anything but independent was ex-New York Fed President Bill Dudley. Dudley wrote that Trump's re-election arguably presents a threat to the United States and global economy, and if the goal of monetary policy is to achieve the best long-term economic outcome, the Fed's officials should consider how their decisions would affect the political outcome of 2020. The timing of Dudley's threats to use Fed monetary policy to affect the outcome of a U.S. election couldn't come at a more striking time. After all, for more than two solid years, Americans have been bombarded with fabricated stories about Russians rigging our elections, and yet here is a Federal Reserve official threatening to do the same exact thing, but this time for real. Whether it's the mainstream media, the CIA, the FBI, or now the Federal Reserve, more and more Americans are waking up to the fact that there is a deep state in America and its interests have nothing to do with American liberty. In fact, our liberty is what the deep state wants to abolish. When it comes to the Federal Reserve, I stand firmly by my conviction that it needs to be audited and then ended as soon as possible. America's founders were not perfect. They were human beings just as capable of error as we are, but they had a remarkable understanding of the ideas of liberty. They understood that liberty cannot exist with a government that has access to a printing press. Sound money and liberty go hand in hand. If we want to enjoy the blessings of liberty, we must audit and then end the Federal Reserve. Military will censor free speech. Special Division of Pentagon may be tasked with ferreting out fake news. By Dave Gallery. The Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, the arm of the U.S. Department of Defense responsible for the development of emerging technologies for use by the military, has been tasked with the job of identifying so-called fake news, and then instituting ways to dispose of it. Of course, one man's fake news is another man's real news, so who's to decide? The Pentagon, apparently. In the past, DARPA was focused on rockets, satellites, weapons, war material, stealth technology, computers, drones, and cool stuff like that. In fact, DARPA created the first computer mouse, 1964, and the forerunner to the Internet, 1969, with the latter released in 1992 for commercial use. Housed at a secretive complex in Arlington, VA, in the Boston Quarter, home to the U.S.'s first shopping center built around a multi-story parking garage, DARPA has around 220 employees in six technical offices who oversee about as many research and development, R&D, projects. Originally called Advanced Research Projects Agency, ARPA, created in 1958 by U.S. President Dwight D. Eisenhower in response to the 1957 launching of Sputnik 1 by the Soviets, DARPA collaborates with industry, academia, and governments to formulate and execute R&D projects to expand the frontiers of technology and science, often beyond immediate U.S. military requirements, most of what DARPA does is top secret, and for good reason. But can we be assured they are working in the people's best interest? With this latest project, we should all be wary. On September 3, DARPA released a post on its website entitled Uncovering the Who, Why, and How Behind Manipulated Media, where the agency lays out its case about the threat of manipulated multimodal media, and why this danger must be confronted and defeated. Multimodal media refers to text, audio, and video, and those pulling DARPA's strings are worried the technology has advanced and become accessible to the point that an average Joe or an ordinary Jane could manipulate the above and spread their creations virally through social media. DARPA plans to use algorithms to spot fake news with malicious intent before it can go viral. The creators of convincing media manipulations are no longer limited to groups with significant resources and expertise. Today, an individual content creator has access to capabilities that could enable the development of an altered media asset that creates a believable, but falsified, interaction or scene, reads the DARPA statement. Apparently, the real fake news media, the New York Times, CNN, etc., isn't fond of competition. DARPA's project to tackle the fake news tsunami is called Semantic Forensics, SEMAFOR for short, which seeks to develop technologies that make the automatic detection, attribution, and characterization of falsified media assets a reality. The goal of SEMAFOR, the post continues, is to develop a suite of semantic analysis algorithms that dramatically increase the burden on the creators of falsified media, making it exceedingly difficult for them to create compelling manipulated content that goes undetected. Simply put, the program hopes to determine how the fake news was created or altered, its purpose, and who did it, so DARPA can quickly determine if it should be deemed a serious threat or something more benign, ultimately to defend against large-scale, automated disinformation attacks. Now, here's where it gets scary. Although the secret algorithms DARPA will program to determine what's real and what's fake, initially to scan and evaluate 250,000 news articles and 250,000 social media posts, the agency is not authorized to remove the fake media. So, who will? Your favorite left-leaning, high-tech giants will be handed that job. Google, Facebook, and other tech giants will morph into DARPA's order takers. That the incestuous relationship between government and industry appears to be entering a new phase should come as no surprise to this newspaper's readers. DARPA has been acting as a revolving door between government and industry for years. In fact, former DARPA director Regina E. Dugan, its first female director, began working for DARPA in 1996, left the agency in 2000, started Dugan Ventures in 2005, came back to DARPA, left in 2012 for Google, went over to Facebook in 2016, and then on to other endeavors, and that's just one of DARPA's directors. Looks like we're in for a new round of serious censorship. It's time to worry. The Hidden History of Gold Bonus 3392-181: How This Censored Secret Can Save the World and Cripple the Bankers. This unique book, The Hidden History of Gold Bonus 3392-181, is deadly for your very top enemies, and it'll save your life, your nation and the world from the global nuclear war. Study it well and act honestly as advised. It is a fraction of the most attacked and banned information ever, and the huge gold program in it was forbidden by the evil top elite to be operated in the USA. It is unknown to you and it provides the only solution to your horrible problems, because by taking the money away from your controllers, the Fed and company, their power will vanish. In fact, they have a colossal debt towards you citizens, not your government, that is much greater than all their assets worldwide, and it is payable only in gold, which is real value, and not in useless paper money. The mainstream media has brainwashed you and you are confused and enslaved. Also unknown to you is the fact that there are two cosmic events we are into, plus planetarian changes, and since the evil elite can't rule the world as they had planned, they want to blow it up, killing 90% of mankind. You Americans haven't got shelters, and hence you are in a deadly trap. Use bonus 3392-181. Become united by the millions, as your enemies are. Stop your silly quarrels to be solved later on, and neutralize the elite who are a fraction of you. Tell the really good authors and patriots to join together their honest supporters. It is your life or death free will choice. You can do it, but hurry, spread the word, order extra copies of this book to pass on to friends and family. Soft cover, 249 pages, $10 each plus S&H. Inside US at $5 S&H on orders up to $50. Add $10 S&H on orders from $50.01 to $100. Add $15 on orders from $100.01 to $200. Add $20 on orders over $200. Outside US quadruple above S&H charges, the authors send payment to AFP, which is acting as the fulfillment service for this book. Send payment to AFP, 117 LaGrange Avenue, La Plata, Doctor of Medicine 20646, or call AFP Fulfillment toll free at 1-888-699-6397, to charge a copy of this one-of-a-kind book. Just $10 while supplies last. Act now to get your copy. Call 1-888-699-6397, toll free Mon, Thursday, September 5th to charge. YouTube on a banning binge world's largest social media companies under pressure from thought police, by John Friend. Late last month, several prominent right-leaning YouTube channels were purged from the popular video sharing site, largely at the behest of radical left-wing activist organizations and malicious journalists, who have been working tirelessly to deplatform and shut down those espousing pro-white, populist political perspectives. Right-Wing Watch, a leading radical left-wing activist organization posing as an independent media outlet that has been active in targeting and smearing content creators for their right-wing political views, reported on August 27 that multiple pro-American YouTube channels were suspended or permanently banned in the wake of the YouTube purge. The YouTube channel of James Alsup, an independent journalist and political activist that this paper has reported on in the past, was entirely deleted, as were the official channels for the American Identity Movement, VDARE, and TRS Radio, right-leaning groups, organizations, and media outlets opposed to excessive immigration, political correctness, anti-white political and media bias, and other aspects of the radical anti-white left-wing agenda. Several other channels were also targeted and banned. Some of the targeted channels, including the official YouTube channel for VDARE, were reinstated by YouTube after further review, but many channels remained shut down, including Alsup's channel, which arguably had the most reach on the popular social media platform with over 400,000 subscribers and millions of views. Like countless other dissident right activists and content creators, Alsup has also been banned from Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and many other popular social media sites and online payment processors. It's gone. Today YouTube decided to delete my channel without cause, Alsup wrote on Gab, an emerging social media platform dedicated to free speech. Following his recent ban from YouTube, I had no channel strikes, no violations, nothing. Simply an email telling me that my livelihood, my means to exercise my political voice, my business I built over almost 3 years, was taken away from me. Right-leaning dissidents and even more mainstream conservatives critical of the radical left-wing agenda to destroy America and traditional Western civilization have faced increasing levels of online censorship and political oppression in recent years. In early June, YouTube issued a press release outlining updated policies and practices the internet giant would be using to more effectively tackle hate and extremism on its platform. In the wake of the announcement, countless YouTube channels were censored or had certain videos deleted. Many others had their channel monetization features disabled. The Anti-Defamation League, ADL, a virulently anti-free speech organization dedicated to stifling America First, populist political perspectives, has worked closely with YouTube, Facebook, and other leading social media and technology giants to combat so-called hate speech and the spread of extremist content. which essentially amounts to any expressed political or historical opinion the organization finds offensive. At the time, the ADL praised YouTube's new policy, calling it an important step forward, but argued that much more needed to be done. Online hate and extremism pose a significant threat, weaponizing bigotry against marginalized communities, silencing voices through intimidation, and acting as recruiting tools for hateful, fringe groups. Jonathan Greenblatt, the CEO of the ADL, said in response to YouTube's updated policies, "That's why ADL has been working with technology companies, including YouTube, to aggressively counter hate on their platforms. We were glad to share our expertise on this and look forward to continuing to provide input. While this is an important step forward, this move alone isn't sufficient and must be followed by many more changes from YouTube and other tech companies to adequately counter the scourge of online hate and extremism." Just weeks before the latest YouTube purge, the ADL released a study highlighting several YouTube channels, including the channel for this newspaper, that continue to disseminate anti-Semitic and white supremacist content despite the company's June 2019 crackdown on hate speech. According to the biased activist organization, many of the channels recently banned by YouTube were featured in the ADL's report, prompting speculation that YouTube is doing the bidding of the ADL in purging dissident right content creators. Following this, YouTube purged several of AFP's videos, including an extremely popular, factual interview with the New Jersey police officer who arrested several admitted Israeli spies, now known as the Dancing Israelis, who were posing as movers following the September 11th attacks. Also summed up what many people who had videos felt about the tech giants' practices. "One of my final videos was 'I will soon be banned and here's why,' in which I detailed how the attacks against me were originating and being pushed by the ADL, a viciously anti-white hate group," Alsop noted on Gab. "They had planted a story that called for my banning and were some of the only ones promoting that story," he continued. "Good job, ADL, by getting me banned after I predicted you would ban me. You have really done a great job proving how little power and control you have over American political discourse. Only a conspiracy theorist would believe that, though, right?" Unsurprisingly, even the latest round of purges by YouTube was not enough to placate or appease the ADL. Greenblatt noted on Twitter that he was glad YouTube was removing some of the channels and videos his subversive, anti-American organization found offensive, but the company has more work to do. The ADL and other anti-American organizations working tirelessly to target and persecute political dissidents in this country are becoming increasingly blatant in their effort to destroy the First Amendment and any semblance of free speech and free intellectual inquiry. Thankfully, more and more Americans are recognizing this subversive agenda, while censored content creators are utilizing alternative media platforms and technologies to express their political views. Advice for Media Matters: Stop whining like crybabies and embrace diversity of opinion. By Paul Angel. When my wife and I had our first baby in 2005, I was surprised, as I guess all parents are, just how much little babies can whine and cry. Sometimes it felt like it went on 24 hours a day. We would offer our precious daughter a pacifier, a spoonful of baby food, or we would rock her gently in a sturdy sweetgrass basket, made by the Gullah people who live on the coastal islands of South Carolina, which we had been given as a gift. Little did I know, I should never have discouraged the baby's whining. Had I just let her perfect her whining and crying, she one day might have been a perfect reporter for Media Matters for America, a well-heeled lobbying group dedicated to shutting up and shutting down all freedom of speech when it comes out of the mouths of anyone but politically correct leftists. Yes, it was a mistake to try to get her to stop whining, because now she could be making a pretty penny doing just that, whining and crying 40 hours a week, for billionaire liberal activist David Brock. According to the National Review, the opportunistic founder of Media Matters, a George Soros-funded anti-free speech coven located in Washington, D.C. Case in point: in May, American Free Press newspaper interviewed tough cop Sheriff Joe Arpaio about some very newsworthy topics, including his unsuccessful bid for the U.S. Senate, the pardon he received from Donald Trump, and his plans for the future. Never one to mince words, Arpaio admitted that he loved our paper, as did tens of thousands of really great Americans across this nation. Sheriff Joe even congratulated AFP for having the guts to speak out. Thanks, Joe. Brock activates his hitman Eric Ananoki, a longtime journalistic hitman for Media Matters, wasted no time in following the marching orders from his affluent higher-ups and immediately crafted a whiny hit piece on Arpaio and AFP. But, as usual, the truth is far removed from the fake news reporting of leftists who get their paychecks to muster up as much manufactured outrage as they can. Ananoki claims in the article that American Free Press is an anti-Semitic outlet that has repeatedly and falsely claimed that the Holocaust is a hoax. However, Media Matters readily admits that AFP scrubbed an interview with author Victor Thorin about a book, not published by AFP, and a book about the Holocaust and the JFK assassination, also not published by AFP, from our website. Is the Holocaust a subject that can never be discussed? Is every claim made by every Holocaust survivor to be accepted as true, when we know, for instance, that multiple survivors have been outed as liars by their own communities? Ananoki also cited an article published on AFP's website about Elie Wiesel with the headline "Meet the Man Who Invented the Holocaust." Of course, what Media Matters fails to admit is that Wiesel's own children sheepishly claim that their father's famous Holocaust book Night is mostly fiction and that the book was originally supposed to have been listed under the category of fiction and literature. According to the publisher, even the Jewish newspaper Forward said the book should not be taken as documentary. So, by the formula of Media Matters, Wiesel cannot be criticized for foisting a phony book on the public, claiming it was fact, simply because he is Jewish. That would be anti-Semitism, we think. If the Jewish Forward says it, it's okay. But if we say it, we're anti-Semites. It's the free speech double standard whiny leftists love to use against truthtellers, especially conservatives. What the heck is anti-Semitism? We would challenge anyone to find something anti-Semitic in American Free Press newspaper, but the problem is, we are not even sure what anti-Semitism is. Is it criticism of the state of Israel, as the Anti-Defamation League insists, guilty? Is it any criticism of the Israel lobby, which is, by all reliable accounts, the most powerful, well-funded, and persuasive lobby in the world, guilty? Is anti-Semitism simply hostility or prejudice against Jews in general, not guilty? Does that mean that the accountant of a homeowners association who embezzles $450,000 from the association, and just happens to be Jewish, cannot be discussed in a newspaper article because of his religion? That is ridiculous. But that's Media Matters for you. Another article quoted by Media Matters to smear AFP as anti-Semitic was entitled "Audio Interview, Jewish Fingerprints All Over 9-11, Excuse Us, But Has Media Matters Never Heard of the Dancing Israelis?" Those known Mossad agents caught filming the World Trade Center towers collapsing on September 11, 2001? Have they never listened to the Israeli talk show in which one of the men arrested that day, held in jail for months and mysteriously deported back to Israel, admits that he was there to film the event? I guess we should just refer to these Israelis as cabbage farmers and never mention their ethnicity. I hate to think if the reporters at Media Matters were ever charged with solving a crime, they wouldn't even know how to find the truth, let alone recognize it if it were staring them in their faces. But, let's face it, they are not paid to write the truth. They are paid to whine and whine and whine. Incredible hypocrisy matters. The hypocrisy of Media Matters is astounding. For instance, to prove AFP is anti-Semitic, they cite a New York Times article on Willis Cardo, who was a consultant for AFP when we founded this newspaper in 2001. Cardo, as many of you know, was an extremely vocal critic of Zionist power, but the problem with casting Cardo as an anti-Semite is that one of his best friends was Mark Lane, the world-renowned Jewish attorney and JFK researcher. Evidently, Cardo needed a few lessons on being a good anti-Semite. Perhaps Cardo should have taken those lessons from the management at the New York Times and or Media Matters presidents Angelo Carusone. But worse than all these blatant lies is the source of the information on Cardo itself. Just recently, according to the National Review, Times reporter Jeremy Peters said that allies of President Trump are employing the opposition research model pioneered by the liberal advocacy group Media Matters to tar journalists that report critically on the Trump administration and any conservatives they don't like. What did the Media Matters model for muckraking uncover at that Times? It found that top officers there were regularly exchanging deeply anti-Semitic jokes in their social media posts. Perhaps that is why they are allegedly experts on anti-Semitism. Times editor Tom Wright P. Rassandy actually sent out a tweet that said, "I was going to say crappy Jew year, but one of my resolutions is to be less anti-Semitic. So, happy Jew year, you Jews." He also included his observations of several bar patrons from India he had encountered during a night out on the town. Wright P. Rassandy tweeted, "There are four Indian guys with mohawks and each one is a douche in his own awful way. I hate mohawk Indians. I don't hate mohawk Indians, though. I love those guys. I just hate Indians with mohawks. Different Indians, different mohawks." Did he say hate? Yes, he said hate. Have you ever seen something like that from American Free Press in any forum? Of course not. Worst of all, though, is the case of Carusone himself, the president of Media Matters for America. After trying to orchestrate an advertiser boycott of conservative talk show host Tucker Carlson, Carlson did a little Media Matters-style yellow journalism and uncovered multiple racist, transphobic, and anti-Semitic smears on Carusone's own social media account. He had on numerous occasions denigrated Jews, Japanese people, people from Bangladesh, who he believes could not possibly be financially successful, and transsexuals. In one post, Carusone described a Jewish man as being handsome, despite his Jewry, and said the man certainly had in his possession several bags of Jewish gold. Ouch, now that's anti-Semitism at its very worst. Julia Stryker would be proud, selling a history book and offering it up to the public in the spirit of free speech, or posting a controversial interview, of which AFP is accused, is nothing like posting ingrained, stereotypical racist beliefs again and again and then trying to lie your way out of it like Carusone did, rather than take responsibility for his deep-seated anti-Semitism and racism. This top dog at Media Matters for America, the self-appointed arbiter of what you can and cannot read and hear, tried to wriggle out of his blatantly anti-Semitic, racist statements by alleging they were some kind of a parody of right-wingers. This was quickly proven to be a really bad cover story that fell apart like tissue paper in a typhoon. But who cares, right? He's a leftist and he works for Media Matters, where the ends justify the means, and the ends are crushing free speech for us but not them, using any means necessary, rules for thee, but not for me. An honest newspaper sheriff Joe, and all of the figures AFP has interviewed over the years, can be assured that AFP reports the news as we see it, with facts but, admittedly, without the poison of political correctness. Truth is our icon, and we refuse to bow down in prayer with Media Matters for America before the altar of political correctness and worship their golden calf, which feeds and grows from their daily offerings of lies, manufactured outrage, fake news, and their own deep-seated racial and religious bigotry. We also refuse to apologize for honoring the spirit of freedom of speech and defending the right of all Americans, whether you be white, black, brown, yellow, red or blue, Christian, Muslim, Buddhist or Jew, to speak their minds on any topics, as long as they don't advocate violence. Will court agree to exhumation? Researcher convinced murder of Dorothy Kilgallen linked to JFK assassination. By St. Patrick, Dorothy Kilgallen looked like your favorite aunt, prim and proper, the one who would wink at you as she snuck a sip from her carefully concealed flask. America knew her from her role as a recurring panelist on the popular game show What's My Line, a role she kept for the final 15 years of her life. On November 8, 1965, Kilgallen was found dead in her five-story Manhattan townhouse. The cause of death was ruled to be a lethal combination of barbiturates and alcohol, a ruling author Mark Shaw disputes. Shaw recently asked the Supreme Court of the state of New York for permission to exhume the body of Kilgallen, the author of The Reporter Who Knew Too Much, the mysterious death of What's My Line TV star and media icon Dorothy Kilgallen. Shaw believes Kilgallen was murdered. In the petition to the state, Shore asks for permission to exhume the late Miss Dorothy Kilgallen, the Pulitzer Prize-nominated media icon who did not die accidentally at the young age of 52 by ingesting one barbiturate but was poisoned with a combination of three dangerous barbiturates in 1965 following her exhaustive 18-month investigation of the JFK assassination. Shaw's 129-page petition is a lot to unpack, and its length resembles that of his book. Essentially, Shaw, under the official guidance of famed forensic pathologist Dr. Cyril Wecht, would like to take a DNA sample of Kilgallen to match with former journalist Ron Paddocky, the last person to see Kilgallen alive and the man Shaw believes murdered her. Paddocky, 84, is still living and would either have to consent to the DNA sample or be court-ordered to submit. Paddocky was the only new person who became close to Kilgallen in her eventful final months. For 18 months Kilgallen had diligently researched a series about the John F. Kennedy assassination. She had doubted the official narrative very early and became the first reporter to print Dallas Police Chief Jesse Curry's initial instructions to his officers, to get a man on top of the overpass and see what happened up there, not get a man inside the Texas School Book Depository, which Curry later claimed. Kilgallen seems to have had a tenuous relationship with the CIA, receiving information from them while also exposing some of their most then-secret misdeeds. For example, she used information from CIA-trained exiles in Miami to write anti-Fidel Castro stories before then becoming the first reporter to imply that the CIA was working with the mafia to assassinate Castro. It was at this point that FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover began dossier on Kilgallen's activities. In 1961, Random House commissioned Kilgallen to write a book called Murder One. She had already become well known for her coverage of infamous murder trials around the United States. The project lasted throughout the remainder of her life, with the JFK assassination pausing its release solely to become its most important section. Kilgallen was holding a secret, and it had something to do with Jack Ruby, Lee Harvey Oswald's assassin. Journalist and first-generation Kennedy assassination researcher Penn Jones wrote, during the Ruby trial in Dallas, Judge Joby Brown granted Miss Kilgallen a privilege given no other newsman. She had 30 minutes alone in a room with Jack Ruby. Even the guards were outside the door. Kilgallen refused to reveal what Ruby had told her. That was to be the most notable and most profitable aspect of her forthcoming book. She even refused to tell researcher Mark Lane, with whom she had worked doggedly throughout her final year. She did give forewarning to one of her best friends, stating, "In 5 days, I'm going to bust this case wide open." Concerned about the alarming number of deaths connected to Kennedy assassination witnesses already happening by 1965, Kilgallen handed a copy of her Jack Ruby chapter to her fellow journalist, fashion editor Florence Smith, before she could bust the case open days later. Kilgallen was dead. 2 days later, Florence Smith was dead of what was officially deemed a cerebral hemorrhage. The Jack Ruby chapter Kilgallen had given Smith disappeared. Shaw contends that Paddocky was aiding many of Kilgallen's enemies in the intelligence world and in the mafia, notably New Orleans mob boss Carlos Marcello. Kilgallen's enemies wanted her dead, and Shaw's petition to exhume seeks to serve the purpose of trying to answer who, so that the search for the why can move closer to finality. After mass shootings, Texas enacts pro-gun laws to protect good guys, by Mark Anderson on September 1, several laws were implemented in Texas that make it easier to store or carry guns in public places for defensive purposes. The bills, passed in May and June, ironically took effect in the immediate aftermath of yet another reported mass shooting in the state, this time in Odessa on August 31. These new laws represent the uniquely bold manner in which Texas seeks to address the state's lengthening list of shootings. The list also includes incidents at Santa Fe High School near Houston in May 2018, at First Baptist Church in Sutherland Springs in November 2017, and at El Paso's Walmart on August 3. The laws include House Bill 1143, under which school districts may not prohibit licensed gun owners, including school employees, from storing a firearm or ammunition in a locked vehicle in school parking lots, provided the items are not in plain view. House Bill 1387 loosens restrictions on how many armed marshals a public school district may appoint. Senate Bill 535 was amended to remove the restriction on licensed gun owners from carrying their weapons in places of worship. The bold moves from Texas follow legislation being proposed in many states and on a national level to curtail Americans' Second Amendment rights. For starters, how can any state, or the nation, rationalize the enactment of arbitrary red flag gun laws when there already are 20,000 local, state, and federal gun regulations on the books? Then there's the unbending insistence by the police and big media that every mass shooting could only have involved one apparent shooter, a stubborn narrative that goes all the way back to Lee Harvey Oswald in terms of Texas lore. According to police accounts out of Midland, Texas, next door to Odessa, CNN noted in its earliest report that, as of now, police believe there are two suspects, both driving in different directions. One suspect is in a small Toyota pickup truck, the other is in a United States Postal Service van. But just one day later, on September 1, when Odessa police, joined by Texas Governor Greg Abbott, held a press conference, they said that while various details still were being sorted out and little was known about the main suspect, the one hard fact was that the apparent assailant, later identified as 36-year-old Seth Aaron Ader, had acted alone and had been shot dead by police before he could enter a crowded movie theater. The discrepancy was more dramatic in El Paso, where eyewitnesses said three armed men dressed in black entered a Walmart's front doors as the shooting started. The mainstream media did not follow up on these claims. Otter still is the Sutherland Springs Church assault on November 5, 2017, reportedly carried out by now-deceased gunman Devin Patrick Kelly. The incident appears to be full of holes, in the sense that the church's one-story exterior appeared to have never been hit by 400 AR-15 rounds, as Pastor Frank Pomeroy claimed. Pictures of that event's immediate aftermath, coupled with AFP's visit to the scene 1 month after the event, show the sanctuary's old stained glass windows fully intact with old caulk crumbling around each window's edge, indicating they had never been disturbed, along with the church exterior still being clad in the old asbestos white siding that's long been discontinued, raising the question of why a church pummeled with hundreds of AR-15 rounds would not have been re-sided with distinctly new, modern materials. Whatever the truth may be about these shootings, it's wise to remember that while it's against statutory law, of course, to commit the felony crime of murder with a firearm, or with any other kind of weapon, it's also constitutionally forbidden to disarm the American people. The public should demand full, unredacted crime reports from police, no matter how disturbing the crime scene photos, autopsy details, and diagrams may be, so there can be a more accurate assessment of the nature of these shootings. Asking tough questions may sound like the work of conspiracy theorists fishing for hoaxes, but the withholding of detailed forensic information, combined with the media's overly emotional reports, which ignore glaring inconsistencies of the case at hand, is what fuels loose theories and makes it especially tough to separate fact from fiction. Leftists Attack Parade Marchers in Boston, by John Friend. A straight pride parade held in downtown Boston the last Saturday in August resulted in multiple scuffles, at least 36 arrests, almost all of whom were leftists, and four injured police officers, according to local reports. In yet another demonstration of the threat the radical left poses to American society and political traditions, estimates vary, but roughly 1,000 participated in the parade in counter-protest, with multiple reports indicating that left-wing counter-protesters, including self-identified Antifa members, outnumbered those participating in the parade. The event sparked controversy from the beginning, with debate raging on both sides as to whether or not such a parade is welcome in Boston, a city known for its left-wing politics. The organizers eventually secured the required permit and largely cooperated with local law enforcement and city officials. Many commentators, including Stephen Colbert, mocked the parade, while other celebrities and left-wing activists expressed their outrage at the event. John Hugo, one of the key organizers of the event, argued that the parade was about protecting the First Amendment and ensuring free speech and assembly can still be exercised in American society, as well as celebrating the oppressed minority of heterosexual Americans who have been suppressed by mainstream cultural institutions in recent years, as the homosexual agenda is forced upon American society. Why is it that other people can have a pride parade and it's considered okay, and they have about 2,000 LGBTQ events every year, but we want a few hours and they all get out and protest and give us the finger and swear at us? Hugo asked in an interview with the Boston Herald. Give me a break, the people who demand tolerance are the most intolerant, he continued, referring to the radical left-wing protesters who targeted the parade and its attendees. That's hypocrisy. The parade, which began at Copley Square and ended at City Hall Plaza in downtown Boston, drew the typically hysterical and confrontational left-wing mob seen at virtually every other conservative right-leaning public event in recent years. Some members of Antifa and other left-wing counter-protesters, who have engaged in premeditated acts of political violence and sabotage with impunity since the 2016 presidential campaign season, attempted to disrupt the event and violently confront those marching in the parade. Local police commendably kept the peace and generally protected the parade attendees' First Amendment rights, as black-led Antifa openly threatened violence against those supporting the parade. We're covered in black, so when we attack these guys we can't be prosecuted, John Crowley, who openly identifies with the Antifa movement, explained to the Boston Herald, demonstrating once again the violent nature of the radical left. The overwhelming majority of those arrested were counter-protesters of the legally sanctioned parade, with charges ranging from disorderly conduct to assaulting a police officer. Many of those arrested and cited during the parade appeared before Boston Municipal Court Judge Richard J. Sinnott this week. Local prosecutors have insisted that charges be dismissed against counter-protesters, but Sinnott has largely refused, an indication that local judicial and law enforcement officials take their oath of office to uphold and defend the Constitution seriously. Lawrence A. Calderon, the vice president of the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association, expressed joy and gratitude that Sinnott was holding those arrested accountable for their actions and refusing to dismiss their charges at the behest of city prosecutors. We think that these offenders that are here, most of them outside of the city of Boston, not residents of Boston, came here as agitators, Calder, one stated, here for a specific reason, here to create havoc, not only for the police department but for the general citizenry that are around, for the visitors that are in downtown Boston trying to enjoy the last weekend of the summer, those concerned about the rule of law and cherished American political traditions such as free speech and assembly also welcome Sinnott's no-nonsense approach to enforcing the law. Bibi's warmongering, by Richard Walker. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's recent offer to help Brazil put out massive fires in the Amazon came as he was starting his own bonfires in the Middle East, where he has a history of promoting political arson. While the outreach to Brazil was designed to promote Israel as a nation interested in the environment, and to capitalize on Netanyahu's close ties to the government there, Netanyahu was busy stoking fires of a different type in Syria and Lebanon. He threatened each country that if it retaliated against Israeli bombing and the deployment of swarms of drones armed with explosives against targets in their nation, they would face the full might of Israel's military. Somewhat ironically, after attacking Lebanon, he told the Lebanese to calm down. It was straight out of Netanyahu's devious playbook. He has been busy for years attacking Hezbollah targets in Lebanon and Iranian facilities in Syria, with the aim of goading Hezbollah and Iran into a military response. Such a response, he is convinced, would then permit him to falsely claim Israel was under attack and that it had the right to retaliate as a matter of self-defense. His long-term aim has been war with Iran and Hezbollah, with the hope that it will draw in the U.S. in the past year. He has begun to feel more emboldened with support from U.S. neocons like Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Recent Israeli attacks in Beirut led Lebanese President Michel Aoun, a Maronite Christian, to declare that Netanyahu's use of armed drones to target Lebanon was an act of war. Netanyahu got the response from Hezbollah that he wanted when its leader, Hassan Nasrallah, threatened that Hezbollah would retaliate for the killing of several of its men in a drone strike. Nasrallah warned Israeli troops on the border with Lebanon that they should be on alert. Netanyahu predictably responded that any threats and actions from Lebanon would be met with a massive military reply. It was classic Netanyahu. Nevertheless, this was not a typical Netanyahu strategy. He has a grander motive for attacking Lebanon and Syria that was not apparent in coverage of the developing crisis in the international media and especially in U.S. mainstream media outlets, which reported the story as they have always done, that Israel was merely targeting its enemies, in particular Iranian proxies who pose a threat, even if no threat is apparent or imminent. To understand the bigger picture, one often has to turn to foreign diplomatic and intelligence sources to get the inside track on what is really going on. This writer learned from talking to longtime sources that Netanyahu and his advisors have panicked ever since President Donald Trump began talking about the prospect of getting a deal with Iran. They fear the televised scenes that would accompany a possible face-to-face meeting between him and Iran's President Rouhani. In an effort to stop this from ever happening, Netanyahu has decided to ramp up tensions in the Middle East with the aim of engaging Iran. So far, Iran has not taken the bait, but who knows what Netanyahu made a shit a summit between Trump and Rouhani become a reality? Israel is increasingly aware that some of the G7 leaders, especially French President Macron, recently pressed President Trump to employ the same strategy he has used with North Korea. In other words, engage Rouhani on a personal level. There is, however, a backstory to all this that has not made news. It is the role being played by the Saudis, who have been working secretly with Israel to prevent any U.S. political rapprochement with Iran. This writer learned about the Saudi element of this crisis by reaching out to a longtime European intelligence source who wished to remain anonymous. The source spelled out the Saudi role and how it dovetailed with Israel's policy. According to the source, the Saudis and Israelis have a joint military intelligence project underway to persuade Trump that Iran is the biggest threat to Middle East peace. Secret meetings have been held in Tel Aviv and Riyadh to plan joint operations against Iran, as well as against Iran's allies in Syria and Lebanon. Netanyahu and the Saudi leader Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, have effectively forged a pact. This development worries the leaders of Russia, China, and some European nations, since MBS is considered by European intelligence chiefs to be a dangerous wild card in the region and someone Netanyahu would not be able to control. This is not a positive development when it appears President Trump could deliver a deal with Iran that would calm the region and bring the Iranians into the Western fold. The source added, the prospect of it happening terrifies Netanyahu and MBS, though I suspect the Israeli people would be relieved to have Iran as an ally, not an enemy. You have to understand that with Netanyahu everything is about his ego, with MBS it is about his hatred of Shia Islam. For the first time in several years, there is a real possibility that there could be an historic meeting between Trump and his Iranian counterpart. It would be applauded by world leaders, and it might signal a new era in U.S. Middle East politics. But, with unseen forces opposed to peace, there is always the likelihood of war. Pollard and the pervert Lewinsky tapes used to blackmail Clinton for spies release. By St. Patrick and Clinton Incorporated, the audacious rebuilding of a political machine, author Daniel Halper released a bombshell that still resonates with many researchers of the deep state today. In 1998, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu attempted to blackmail President Bill Clinton with tapes of Clinton and intern Monica Lewinsky's most salacious phone calls. What Netanyahu wanted was the release of spy Jonathan Pollard. Pollard was a U.S. naval analyst who in 1987 was convicted of spying and passing top-secret documents to Israeli intelligence. As part of a plea agreement for violating the Espionage Act, Pollard was given a life sentence. Pollard's release had become a cause célèbre for conservative Israeli politicians such as those in Netanyahu's Likud party. Netanyahu has a vested interest in the success of Israeli intelligence. After graduating high school, he devoted 5 years to the highly secretive Sayeret Matkal, the Special Forces Unit of the Israel Defense Forces, IDF. In 1998, Netanyahu was in Maryland attending the Clinton-hosted Y River talks between Israel and the Palestinian Authority. According to Alper, at one point, Netanyahu pulled the president aside to tell him that the Israelis had overheard the potentially damaging phone calls with Lewinsky. According to information provided by a CIA source, Alper wrote, a stricken Clinton appeared to buckle, not wanting to directly threaten the powerful American president, a crucial Israeli ally. Clinton was told that the Israeli government had thrown the tapes away, but the very mention of them was enough to constitute a form of blackmail. Though Halper could not get U.S. intelligence officials to confirm for him the extent of the Israeli eavesdropping that was active in the 1990s, Insight magazine in 2000 reported that Israel had penetrated no fewer than 4 telephone lines into the White House. From a remote location in Washington, D.C., the Israelis were able to immediately relay transmissions from those lines to Israel. While it seems obvious that they would have been recorded and kept for such purposes as they were used at Y River, Israel, of course, has called the claims outrageous. While most of Clinton Incorporated stems from on their court conversations in the Monica files, sets of documents gathered for potential use in possible future litigation between Clinton and Lewinsky, it could easily be charged that Halper, a former online editor with the conservative Weekly Standard, was yet another cog in the vast right-wing conspiracy. That is, if no less than the New York Times had not all but validated Halper's story, the Netanyahu-Clinton conversation regarding Pollard was confirmed in a November 1998 Times article by James Risen and Steve Erlanger. Clinton had gone to Director of Central Intelligence George Tenet about the possible release. Tenet threatened to resign if Clinton acquiesced to Netanyahu's request. The Times reporters quoted White House spokesman David C. Levy concerning why Clinton appeared to have a change of heart on an issue he had not seriously considered before and an issue that caused American law enforcement and intelligence officials to go into nearly open rebellion. According to Levy, at Y River, Clinton had been impressed by the force of Mr. Netanyahu's arguments on Pollard. One U.S. official told the Times that until Tenet spoke up forcefully, Pollard's release was clearly on the table. Pollard is a special case within spycraft. In his nearly 18 months of espionage in 1984 and 1985, he had purloined more top secret documents than almost any other spy in American history, and this was for an Israeli government that publicly professes a shared kinship with their American counterparts. Since 1998, almost every high official in defense and intelligence has commented on Pollard's situation. A bevy of strange bedfellows has populated both sides of the argument over clemency. The late Senator Arlen Specter, ARPA, even argued for a full pardon. Presidents from Reagan to Obama refused to release Pollard on clemency despite an overwhelming wave of political support from D.C. to do so. Pollard was released on parole, a legal condition at the time Pollard was convicted for those who have served over 30 years of a life sentence. On November 20, 2015, his parole restrictions have remained stringent, despite multiple attempts by attorneys at lessening or releasing them altogether. He has been ordered to stay in New York City for 5 years. After that, it is believed he will emigrate to Israel, a returning hero to a land and a people that were never really his own. Halper knew what would happen to him when Clinton Incorporated was released. He was well aware that the former, and perhaps future, First Family and its massive retinue of loyalty enforcers, professional defamers, and assorted gadflies would rue my intent to examine the real Clintons. But unlike many who have exposed the Clinton family's past and present transgressions, Halper today remains alive, an editor for the news website Drudge Report. Gay gene study shocks liberal scientists conclude homosexuality is a lifestyle choice, not a genetic condition. By Dr. Kevin Barrett. Throughout most of human history, homosexuality, especially open homosexual behavior, has been discouraged. One thing the Abrahamic monotheistic religions of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam all agree on is that God destroyed the people of Sodom and Gomorrah as punishment for their out-of-control public homosexual behavior. The other great religions, too, condemn homosexual acts. The Dalai Lama, to take one well-known example, has repeatedly violated the liberal taboo on criticizing homosexuality. Why? Because Buddhist teachings clearly oppose all forms of sodomy. During the past few decades, the homosexual rights movement has overturned the collective traditional wisdom of the human race. Sodomy is now considered a basic human right. Liberals say that some people are born gay. It would be cruel and discriminatory to deny them the same right to sexual satisfaction and marriage as everyone else. Conservatives view sexual preference as more learned than innate. They argue that homosexual acts, like other deviant sexual practices, are choices available to all, but bad choices that generally ought to be discouraged, whether by custom, religion, force of law, or all of the above. So who is right? The liberal belief that people are born gay has just been debunked by a highly authoritative new scientific study, shattering the whole basis of the argument that homosexuality is a basic human right. According to the new study published August 30 in Science magazine, less than one-third of an individual's propensity to engage in homosexual acts can be explained by genetics, and this influence is the result of combinations of many genetic influences. In other words, there is no gay gene. Nobody is born gay. The researchers found that the sum total of various detectable genetic factors had only a small influence, between 8% and 25%, on the likelihood of someone's homosexuality. So what kind of genes make it a little bit more likely that the person will engage in homosexual acts? The New York Times reported, in a finding that could be especially sensitive, the researchers found that whether someone ever engaged in same-sex sexual behavior showed genetic correlations with mental health issues, like major depressive disorder or schizophrenia, and with traits like risk-taking, cannabis use, openness to experience, and loneliness. It is certainly understandable that someone who feels unusually lonely might go to a gay bar. Someone who seeks out unusual experiences might try sodomy and get hooked on it, or that someone who craves risk might be unusually willing to risk contracting AIDS and other diseases by engaging in adventurous non-procreative sexual behavior. But none of this offers the slightest support to the now falsified notion of being born gay, since there is no such thing as a homosexual or a gay person, just sexual acts that all people can choose or avoid. Liberals arguing for a basic human right to sodomy will have to abandon the born gay paradigm in favor of libertarianism. That is, they will have to argue that neither religion nor state nor custom should impede or regulate the sexual behavior of consenting individuals. At first glance, this argument seems persuasive. Why should any of us worry about what other people do with their own bodies? Conservatives answer that the collective wisdom of the ages dictates that sexuality should be restricted to reproductive relationships. The basis of all human relationships is the reproductive family. Channeling sexual desire, especially the testosterone-fueled desires of young males, away from debauchery, rape, and pillage, and toward caring for women and children and other weaker members of society, is the most basic human imperative. Any society that makes no effort to restrict sexuality to heterosexual reproductive marriage, but instead allows it to run rampant, will soon suffer the fate exemplified, in extreme form, in the stories of Sodom and Gomorrah. Conservatives, following the great Christian thinker René Girard, also note that public displays of sexuality tend to excite imitation. So while private sexual behavior, as long as it is genuinely private, that is, unknown to others, is not a problem, public sexual display or communication will always tend to stir up others and tempt them to imitate whatever is being displayed or communicated. In today's post-Christian West, each generation pleasures itself by breaking the previous generation's taboos. Which taboos will be broken next? Will incest, necrophilia, and bestiality soon be viewed as basic human rights? Will public sex become the norm? Will adults claim the basic human right to have sex with consenting children and animals? Will the United Nations try to force these practices on all of the world's peoples, including those who have held more tightly to their sacred traditions than Westerners have? Studies contradict leftist narrative that white cops are racist killers. By Donald Jeffries, a recent study from Michigan State University and the University of Maryland flatly contradicts the popularly held, mainstream media-driven notion that white police officers are targeting black citizens. The research, in fact, demonstrates that white police officers are not more likely to shoot minorities than non-white officers are. Until now, there's never been a systematic, nationwide study to determine the characteristics of police involved in fatal office or involved shootings, Michigan State University professor and study co-author Joseph Cesario declared. There are so many examples of people saying that when black citizens are shot by police, it's white officers shooting them. In fact, our findings show no support that black citizens are more likely to be shot by white officers, Cesario went on to say. We found that the race of the officer doesn't matter when it comes to predicting whether black or white citizens are shot. If anything, black citizens are more likely to have been shot by black officers, but this is because black officers are drawn from the same population that they police. So, the more black citizens there are in a community, the more black police officers there are, Cesario bluntly maintained. Many people ask whether black or white citizens are more likely to be shot and why. We found that violent crime rates are the driving force behind fatal shootings. Our data show that the rate of crime by each racial group correlates with the likelihood of citizens from that racial group being shot. If you live in a county that has a lot of white people committing crimes, white people are more likely to be shot. If you live in a county that has a lot of black people committing crimes, black people are more likely to be shot. It is the best predictor we have of fatal police shootings. The response from the academic world to Cesario's findings was predictable. He was criticized for a decision to sidestep the benchmark of using population as a determining factor in calculating racial disparity. Princeton professor Jonah Thanmimalo, for example, argued that flawed methodology assumes that black and white officers encounter black civilians in equal numbers, or in even temperaments. University of Nebraska professor Justin Nix, in a 2017 study, found that police had killed nearly twice as many whites as blacks that year. An independent study of all the numerous cases of egregious police behavior, documented in videos by victims, onlookers, and the police cameras of law enforcement itself, shows a great diversity in those harassed, tasered, and shot. There is just as much diversity in terms of law enforcement officers who act inappropriately. In one of the more horrendous miscarriages of justice imaginable, homeless man Kelly Thomas was viciously beaten to death by a group of police officers in July 2011. One of the two officers actually charged in the case, and the one who precipitated the violence, was Manuel Ramos, who is Hispanic. The victim here, Thomas, was white. The entire crime was caught on videotape, as Thomas repeatedly pled for his life and called out for his father. Despite this documented evidence, a brain-dead jury found the officers not guilty. As in seemingly all cases of police brutality, the brotherhood comes together, and in this instance, the officer's superior, Stephen Rubio, ludicrously maintained that the only slight violation of department policy he witnessed while watching the entire 33-minute video was the officer's use of profanity. Other notable examples of law enforcement abusing their authority include the female officer, who'd already been transferred from another police force after shooting a woman reaching into her purse, who shot and killed a young white male who answered her knock at his front door with a video game controller in his hand. In 2017, Australian-born white woman Justine Damond was shot and killed by Somali-born Minneapolis police officer Mohammed Noor as she leaned into the driver's side window of the squad car. Damond had called the police to report a loud altercation in the neighborhood, and was calmly talking to Noor's partner at the time. In a typically underreported 2014 incident, unarmed 20-year-old white Dylan Taylor was shot and killed outside a Utah convenience store by a black police officer. White, black, and Hispanic officers have been caught on film shooting deaf people who naturally didn't respond to their verbal commands, in the back, shooting jaywalkers, slamming skateboarder kids to the pavement, and throwing people of all races and genders out of wheelchairs. The only constant in these tragic cases is the failure of either law enforcement oversight or the legal system to hold bad police officers accountable for their behavior and the inconsistent press coverage, of course, which all depends upon the races of the victims and officers, but generally portrays all white police officers as dangerous. California court overturns conviction of illegal alien killer of Kate Steinle. Sanctuary state jury shoots down gun conviction of repeat offender. By John Friend. An appeals court in San Francisco has overturned the conviction of an illegal alien who shot and killed 32-year-old Kate Steinle. Her senseless death in the summer of 2015 sparked outrage and fueled a debate over illegal immigration in the lead-up to the 2016 presidential election. In late August, the First District Court of Appeal in San Francisco overturned the one conviction against Jose Inez Garcia Zarate, who had previously been acquitted of first and second-degree murder, involuntary manslaughter, and assault with a semi-automatic weapon in November 2017. For his role in Steinle's death, Garcia Zarate was convicted of one count of being a felon in possession of a firearm by the state of California, but even that conviction has now been dismissed after the state appeals court overturned it. Garcia Zarate still remains in federal custody and is facing federal charges relating to gun possession and illegally residing in the country. The man, who has had many run-ins with law enforcement for drug-related crimes in several states including multiple felony charges, had previously been deported from the United States to his native Mexico on five separate occasions, yet continued to re-enter the country illegally. The state court ruling has no legal effect on the federal prosecution, which will continue, U.S. Attorney David Anderson stated following the appeals court ruling. A repeatedly deported, previously convicted felon has no right to possess a firearm under federal law, even if California extends him sanctuary, according to court records. On July 1, 2015, Garcia Zarate was present at the Embarcadero near the waterfront in San Francisco, a popular tourist hotspot. Steinle was walking with her father and another friend near Pier 14 when she was struck by a stray bullet that was fired from a gun Garcia Zarate picked up. Garcia Zarate's attorneys have argued that the drug-addled illegal alien did not realize he had picked up a gun, which was wrapped in a t-shirt, until he had accidentally misfired it. The bullet ricocheted after being fired, eventually striking Steinle in the back, resulting in her death. Garcia Zarate then threw the gun, which was later discovered to have been stolen from a Bureau of Land Management agent's car, into the water off the pier, and proceeded to walk away before he was apprehended. The young woman's tragic death was used as a rallying cry for immigration hawks and think candidate Donald Trump, who repeatedly invoked Steinle's death during rallies and other speaking engagements to highlight the dangers of illegal immigration and open borders, along with the perils of sanctuary cities in states like California. Months before Steinle's death, Garcia Zarate was released from custody after a drug case against him was dropped by local authorities in San Francisco. Because of the city and state's liberal sanctuary laws, federal immigration officials were not made aware of his release, even though he was residing in the country illegally and was a serial criminal. Kate Steinle was tragically killed because San Francisco proudly proclaims itself a sanctuary city. U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services Acting Director Ken Cuccinelli tweeted following the appeals court decision, "How many more innocents will die before sanctuary cities stop harboring violent criminals? This defies common sense, public safety, and human decency." The San Francisco Police Officers Association was equally as critical of both state and local officials' handling of the case and the absurd sanctuary laws, which protect illegal aliens rather than American citizens. "This is yet another disgusting injustice perpetrated by a broken criminal justice system that is more intent on reharming victims of crime and their families than holding violent offenders accountable," Tony Montoya, the president of the Police Officers Association, stated in the aftermath of the state appeals court decision. "Timing not yet right for tariffs," by Dr. Paul Craig Roberts. Economist Michael Hudson once said, "Lenin said that capitalists would sell the communists a rope to hang them, but as matters turned out, capitalists let China sell them the labor that served to hang American capitalism." I was surprised to be given credit by readers for Trump ordering American corporations out of China and to bring the jobs back to the American workers that the corporations had abandoned. American economists, financial media, and Washington policymakers had never paid any attention to my analysis of U.S. economic decline in terms of globalism and the offshoring of U.S. jobs and technology, and I thought readers hadn't, either. Many readers tell me that economics is over their heads. My economic articles are the least read on my website. I was again surprised when foreign media, including Press TV in far distant Iran, immediately contacted me requesting an interview about my influence on the White House. What does it all mean? First, I will say that it is possible that someone showed Trump my tariffs column, and that the light switched on. But it is also possible that Trump ordering the corporations home is just an escalation in his threats and reflects not his understanding but the impotence of tariffs to correct the lack of good jobs for Americans and the decline in their real incomes. However, in the event a light went on in the White House, and that Trump might be shown how to proceed in bringing the offshore jobs back to America where they belong, I will address the issue. When the Soviet Union unexpectedly and suddenly collapsed, China and India gave up on socialism and opened their economies to Western capital. The Soviet Union did not collapse because Reagan won the Cold War, a goal that Reagan disavowed, but because hardline elements in the Communist Party leadership were concerned that Mikhail Gorbachev was careless in trusting the Americans and was retreating from the Soviet Empire too cavalierly, to halt the dissolution of the empire that protected Russia from land invasion. The hardline communists placed Gorbachev under house arrest. It was this that initiated the collapse that left Boris Yeltsin, a Washington puppet, in charge, as Washington dismantled the Soviet Union and proceeded to steal, together with Israel, Russia's resources. The conclusion reached by India and China, the countries with the largest populations, was that socialism leads to collapse, but capitalism leads to riches. For the first time, the vast underemployed labor resources of the world's two most populous countries were available for foreign exploitation. The labor could be exploited, that is, paid less than its contribution to output, because an immense oversupply of labor existed in the labor market. The excess supply of labor meant that a workforce could be hired for far less than it contributed to the corporation's earnings. Corporate CEOs and directors, and Wall Street, noticed this opportunity to increase profits. The first corporations that rushed into China were disappointed, and the word went out that the opportunity wasn't as good as it looked. But China worked to make offshore production a lucrative adventure, and manufacturing jobs left the U.S. in the droves. The consequence was that the U.S. middle class shrank, and with it the tax base of states and cities. America ceased to prosper, but the economic hurt was covered up with fake inflation, employment, and GDP growth reports, and Federal Reserve printing of massive amounts of money that propped up the prices of financial assets and real estate. When the hurt became harder to hide, China was blamed for hurting American workers by exporting too much to America. The people blaming China did not bother to look at the percentage of imports from China that consisted of Apple computers and iPhones, Nike shoes, Levi Strauss jeans, etc. The offshore production of U.S. firms constitutes a large percentage of imports. Goods and services produced by U.S. firms offshore count as imports when they are brought back to the U.S. to sell. In other words, the Chinese import problem was in fact the offshore production of U.S. firms brought back to sell to Americans who no longer were involved in the production of the goods and services and, therefore, did not have any income from the production of what they purchased. In contrast, the offshore and corporate shareholders were rolling in money. India benefited from receiving U.S. technology and software engineering jobs, which could be performed anywhere in the work product sent over the internet. Indian education and English language skills made it easy for U.S. tech firms to use work visas to bypass U.S. university graduates. What resulted over the last quarter century was the dismantling of the supply chains and labor force that supported American manufacturing and industry. The once booming factories and industrial sites are closed and run down or converted into condos or apartments. If Trump can bring the U.S. corporations home, where do they go? The offshoring era wasn't a six-month economic recession. It was years when skilled and experienced labor aged and died, and no new entrants learn the skills and work discipline. Today, China is a fully developed manufacturing and industrial economy. The United States is not. For U.S. corporations to come back home, they have to leave a developed economy in China for a semi-developed or undeveloped one in the U.S. if they are compelled to do this all at once. They will lose their production in China before they can recreate the plant and equipment, workforce, supply chains, and transportation systems essential to renew the U.S. as a manufacturing and industrial power. If you look at the payroll jobs reports, it has been many years since the U.S. created manufacturing and industrial jobs. A quarter century of capitalist flight from the American workforce has left the United States similar to India a half century ago, a country whose jobs consist mainly of lowly paid domestic service jobs. The absence of livable jobs is why so many Americans aged 24-34 cannot live an independent existence and live at home with parents or grandparents. It is why university graduates cannot repay their student loans and have been turned into debt slaves. In order to bring American corporations home from China, this is what Trump has to do. The transition has to be gradual. The corporations can only phase out their offshore production in China as they can recreate the necessary conditions for producing in the U.S. The process is, in effect, like bringing development to an undeveloped economy. Trump, that is, the U.S. government, will have to compensate the corporations for the enormous increase in their labor and regulatory liability, etc., costs associated with again producing for U.S. markets with U.S. labor by changing the way the corporation's income is taxed. Companies that produce for their domestic market with domestic labor would have a low tax rate. Companies that produce abroad with foreign labor for their U.S. market would have a high tax rate. The difference in the tax rates can be calculated to offset the labor cost differential. Companies that produce abroad for sale abroad would not be affected. If Trump orders U.S. corporations out of China before they can reconstruct the conditions for manufacturing and industry in the U.S., the firms will be without sales and revenues and fail. The question is raised whether Trump can order U.S. firms to leave China and return home. There are two reasons Trump's order might be simply rhetoric. One is that the corporations are content with their existing profits that flow from low-cost labor and have no intention of losing the cost savings. U.S. global corporations have the wealth to interfere in U.S. elections and elections in every country in which they have a presence. If Trump goes against the global corporations, he will not receive their campaign funds. His opponent will. Instead, Trump can make the argument that the offshoring deal only worked for the corporations, not for the American people. Free market economists gave assurances that better jobs would take the place of the manufacturing jobs moved offshore and that offshore production would pay back to the U.S. consumer in lower prices more than the loss of wages from the offshore jobs. This was not the case. Have any of you experienced lower prices of Nike shoes, Levi jeans, or Apple computers and iPhones? The corporations did not deliver on the free market promise. They lowered their costs but kept the prices up. Not a single one of the better jobs materialized. Trump will need these arguments to put the corporations on the defensive. The second reason is that Trump is alleged not to have the power to order U.S. corporations to leave China and to return to their American workforce, whatever is left of it. At one time this was probably the case. In 1952, President Truman nationalized the American steel industry in order to prevent a strike that would have stopped steel production during the Korean War. The Supreme Court ruled against Truman. But today, after the extraordinary accumulation of powers in the presidency from the Clinton, George W. Bush, and Obama regimes, and the powers given by Congress to the executive branch to fight the war on terror, the president can rule by executive order. Trump has cited the 1977 International Emergency Economic Powers Act as law empowering him to order U.S. firms home from China. He has many additional powers. A president who has the power to detain in violation of habeas corpus U.S. citizens indefinitely without evidence presented to a court, and who can order the execution of U.S. citizens on suspicion alone without due process of law, can order whatever he wants. Based on the powers created by Republicans during the George W. Bush regime and Democrats during the Obama regime, Trump has the power to arrest CEOs and boards of directors who have offshore production on the grounds that they are conspiring with China to steal American jobs and to drive the United States down into the ranks of third world countries. A far better case could be made for this than for the absurd Russiagate story that was used to stop Trump from normalizing relations with Russia. Trump is correct that if the U.S. is to remain a world power, it is necessary to restore manufacturing and industrial capability. If the U.S. is to absorb the massive number of third world peoples it has admitted, it is necessary to restore middle-class jobs and the ladders of upward mobility. The way Trump should proceed is to explain to the corporations that they have inflated their profits in the near term at the cost of destroying consumer purchasing power, and thereby their sales, in the longer term. Americans whose real incomes are not rising do not have the discretionary purchasing power with which to purchase the goods and services that provide revenues to U.S. corporations. Of course, the CEOs and directors are not here in the longer run, and they might not care, but a president can make it a patriotic issue and put them on the spot. Next, Trump needs to work with the corporations to alter the way they are taxed and to recreate the conditions necessary to restore manufacturing in the U.S. This is not a simple task. It requires cooperation, not conflict. In the meantime, immigration must be put on hold, as there is no economy to absorb the immigrants, and Washington needs to stop its wars. The associated costs, debt, and risks are far greater than the benefits. If the U.S. does not reverse its course, it will end up an undeveloped country. This is a far greater threat to us than alleged dictators and alleged terrorists supporting states in the Middle East. Will Trump finally end the war in Afghanistan? U.S. embroiled in far too many foreign wars. By Patrick J. Buchanan. In mid-August, President Donald Trump met in New Jersey with his national security advisors and envoys Almi Khalilzad, who is negotiating with the Taliban to bring about peace, and a U.S. withdrawal from America's longest war. U.S. troops have been fighting in Afghanistan since 2001, in a war that has cost 2,400 American lives. Following the meeting, Trump tweeted, "Many on the opposite sides of this 19-year war, and us, are looking to make a deal, if possible. Some, however, want no deal. They are fighting for absolute power." On August 17, a wedding in Kabul with 1,000 guests was hit by a suicide bomber who, igniting his vest, massacred 63 people and wounded 200 in one of the greatest atrocities of the war. ISIS claimed responsibility. 2 days later, 10 bombs exploded in restaurants and public squares in the eastern city of Jalalabad, wounding 66. Trump is pressing Khalilzad to negotiate drawdowns of U.S. troop levels from the present 14,000, and to bring about a near-term end to U.S. involvement in a war that began after we overthrew the old Taliban regime for giving sanctuary to Osama bin Laden. Is it too soon to ask, what have we gained from our longest war? Was all the blood and treasure invested worth it? And what does the future hold, if the Taliban could not be defeated by an Afghan army, built up by the U.S. for a decade and backed by 100,000 U.S. troops in 2010 to 2011, then are the Taliban likely to give up the struggle when the U.S. is drawing down the last 14,000 troops and heading home? The Taliban control more of the country than they have at any time since being overthrown in 2001, and time now seems to be on their side. Why have they persevered and prevailed in parts of the country? Motivated by a fanatic faith, tribalism, and nationalism, they have shown a willingness to die for a cause that seems more compelling to them than what the U.S.-backed Afghan government has on offer. They also have the guerrilla's advantage of being able to attack at times and places of their own choosing, without the government's burden of having to defend towns and cities. Will these Taliban, who have lost many battles but not the war, retire from the field and abide by democratic elections once the Americans go home? Why should they? The probability, when the Americans depart, the war breaks out anew, and the Taliban ultimately prevail, and Afghanistan is but one of the clashes and conflicts in which America is engaged. Severe U.S. sanctions on Venezuela have failed to bring down the Nicolas Maduro regime in Caracas but have contributed to the immiseration of that people, 10% of whom have left the country. Trump now says he is considering a quarantine or blockade to force Maduro out. 8 years after we helped to overthrow Muammar Gaddafi, Libya is still mired in civil war, with its capital, Tripoli, under siege. Yemen, among the world's humanitarian disasters, has seen the UAE break with its Saudi interventionist allies, and secessionists split off southern Yemen from the Houthi-dominated north. Yet, still, Congress has been unable to force the Trump administration to end all support of the Saudi war. 2,000 U.S. troops remain in Syria. The northern unit is deployed between our Syrian Kurd allies and the Turkish army. In the south, they are positioned to prevent Iran and Iranian-backed militias from creating a secure land bridge from Tehran to Baghdad to Damascus to Beirut. In our confrontation with Iran, we have few allies. The Brits released the Iranian tanker they seized at Gibraltar, which had been carrying oil to Syria. But when the Americans sought to prevent its departure, a Gibraltar court ruled against the United States. Iran presents no clear or present danger to U.S. vital interests, but the Saudis and Israelis see Iran as a mortal enemy and want the U.S. military rid them of the menace. Hong Kong protesters wave American flags and seek U.S. support of their demands for greater autonomy and freedom in their clash with their Beijing-backed authorities. The Taiwanese want us to support them and sell them the weapons to maintain their independence. The Philippines wants us to take their side in the dispute with China over tiny islets in the South China Sea. We are still committed to go to war to defend South Korea, and the North has lately test-fired a series of ballistic missiles, none of which could hit the USA, but all of which could hit South Korea. Around the world, America is involved in quarrels, clashes, and confrontations with almost too many nations to count. In how many of these are U.S. vital interests imperiled, and in how many are we facing potential wars on behalf of other nations, while they hold our coat and egg us on?